Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, and we're going to continue our ongoing conversations on the cultures of consciousness. When I first started getting interested in occult matters and magic and alchemy and astrology and mysticism, I mostly got my information from used bookstores. I was growing up in the 70s and early 80s, and so there was a lot of the literary refuse of the countercultural generation before me, and that really became the main source of a lot of my interest in these matters, which we, of course, talk about frequently here on Expanding Mind. And nowadays, of course, people turn to the Internet, where there's copious amounts of information and misinformation on these topics, as there are on all other topics. And indeed, the Internet has played a significant role in kind of changing the way that people think about these mysterious traditions. But one place where you would not, and I certainly never expected to discover much of any substance about the occult and related traditions is the university. In fact, part of the appeal of this stuff to me, and I think to a lot of people, is that for the most part it's precisely outside the flows of university life, of history and literature and art history and science and social sciences, that you find this kind of material. But that is changing and has been changing for, a couple of decades now. And I'm incredibly happy that today we have one of the leading world architects of this change, the emergence of what he likes to refer to as esotericism, as a field of study, as a way of approaching history, of a way of understanding something historically and tying these traditions that are often thought of in very mysterious terms, secret, underground currents that connect ancient Gnosticism to contemporary conspiracies and secret societies. Well, there's actually historical versions of those kinds of stories. They may not be quite as fabulous in some ways, but in a lot of other ways, they're much more interesting and engaging and, I think, productive, not only in a historical sense, but in light of a lot of the issues we continue to face and face in just as human beings trying to make our way through a world between science and mind, etc. And one of Professor Honegoff's first books was called New Age Religion and Western Culture, and he was one of the first scholars to really take the New Age seriously as a kind of way of approaching the world, way of thinking about the world that had certain kind of deep patterns that he tied to much older currents of esoteric thinking and the so-called occult, and really helped really create a great way of approaching New Age issues. More recently, he's published Esotericism and the Academy, which really looks at the first glance might seem a bit navel-gazing. It's an academic talking about the history of the Academy, and yet it's actually a very fascinating look into how certain kinds of knowledge, certain kinds of experiences, certain kinds of discourse get marginalized by mainstream humanities and university academic scholarly mechanisms, and indeed created this whole world of the sort of outsider language of mysteries and occult experiences and astrology and hidden forces. So it's a really wonderful text. Both of these are, you know, serious scholarly works, and for people who don't necessarily want to plow through 400 pages of dense footnoted material, Professor Honegoff has wonderfully opted to write a more popular volume that has just come out called Western Esotericism, A Guide for the perplexed. This is a wonderful book. I highly recommend it to people who are interested in these topics, of, you know, listeners to this show, because it's very concise, lays out great historical background, and talks about some fundamental ways of understanding and organizing what can be a very mysterious, complicated, contradictory, elusive, incoherent set of sources. And so it's a very good book for clarifying where this stuff comes from, what are some of the major issues and factors involved, and how we think about it as part of our world, not necessarily just a hidden secret esoteric zone that only the initiates are aware of, but really how these esoteric and occult topics are just part of modern existence and continue to be transformed along with everything else as we plunge into the technological age. So I'm very happy to have Professor Honegroff on the show. But before we bring him on, of course, our co-host here on Expanding Mind, Maja Daou, the White Witch of Los Angeles, astrologer extraordinaire. How are you doing, Maja?
I'm good, Eric. Yeah,
now
you know,
got a little bit of your voice back?
I know, I can talk finally. I did a little magic. it's so interesting, you know, because I have firsthand, personally, experienced being banned, straight out banned from teaching a course at a university, specifically because I practice magic. And yet, the same university would have a scholar teaching a class on the subject. So there, we've made some headway where you can, like, talk about this stuff now in universities, but there's still a real big block from people actually participating or enacting these things, which of course also belies the studies where people are reticent to actually do experiments with magic or mesmerism or any of the correspondence stuff, or actually, like, you know, formulate some kind of university level scholarly experiment with magic. There's a few people that are, you know, we got Dean Radin, we got some folks that are trying to actually do it, but I love what you said about just the difference between, you know, engaging in the research of it and looking at the history of it and trying to, like, have it be accepted, which of course was one of the papers that he wrote about, you know, legitimizing magic and having to do it, when really what I would like is for people to just do it, like, just try it. You can research the heck out of it and look at it, but until you kind of, like, just kind of see it for yourself, just like anything you would do, like, how would you experience anything else? I don't know what all the hoopla is or why people in universities are just like, oh, no, we can talk about it, but we can't do it.
I think this is a great topic we'll bring up. I'm sure it's something that we'll be discussing with Professor Honegroff, the issue of practice and how it folds into how we think about things in a scholarly and historical way. It's, of course, very, very important issues. But with that, let's bring on Professor Honegroff to the show. Thank you so much for joining us on Expanding Mind.
Yes, hello, Eric. It's very good to be on the show.
Wonderful.
I look forward to this conversation. I just listened to your whole introduction and very curious what you want to talk about.
Well, yes, we'll plunge in here. Well, one place that I'd like to start is, since the field of esotericism as it's developing today did not exist when you were a younger scholar, when you were working out and finding your way and deciding what you were interested in talking about, and you know, you weren't able to just take classes in the kinds of courses that you are now teaching and so many other people are teaching around the world. So I'm kind of curious how you found your way yourself from your own earlier interests into being attracted to this material or interested in this material, and then really realizing that there was a whole new sort of really a kind of a discipline to develop around it, because it had been so much rejected, as you put it. So I'm curious to hear how you got into the topic.
Yeah, right. Well, it happened like this. Maybe a first reason I got interested has nothing to do with my academic interest so much, but I first studied music, and I was interested in understanding why we find music and art and literature and poetry important. And I always felt that that the arts, including music, which was my profession at the time, was not just some kind of amusement, but conveyed some kind of knowledge, that you learned something from it, that it gives you some kind of knowledge. That was kind of a background question. And it has always kept interesting me up to the present. And it is because one of the fundamental aspects in the study of esotericism is the question of gnosis, a Greek word which means knowledge, and the idea that there is some kind of privileged individual knowledge that that is possible to attain. And I've always felt, this is how I started, that music and other forms of art can give some kind of knowledge which is not rational, which is different, which is not scientific, but which is somehow experiential. So that was a kind of a background interest. And then I was studying a kind of very interdisciplinary program at the University of Utrecht in the Netherlands. And I just by chance I came across a book, a German book, which and I happened to read German and to like the language. I started reading it. It was written by an ethnologist of the first part of the 20th century, Will Erich Peukert. It was called Pansophie, a history of black and white magic. It was written in a very engaging, romantic, beautiful language. I loved it. And it was talking about all these figures that I'd never heard about. He was talking about Renaissance thinkers like Marsilio Ficino, the Platonist, about Pico della Mirandola, the Kabbalist, about Jacob Böhme, the visionary shoemaker from Görlitz in Germany, about Agrippa, the writer on magic in the Renaissance. And to be honest, I was reading this. Peukert made very clear that these people were not marginal figures, but that they were actually incredibly important and influential in their time. And I got, let me say, I was intellectually offended by the fact that nobody had ever told me anything about these people. At school, secondary school, whatever, nobody had told me that these people even existed. And I learned from this book that not only did they exist, they were fascinating, they were important and influential. So I started asking my teachers at university, you know, I want to learn more about this stuff. And then I realized very quickly that they felt embarrassed about the topic. They started, like I sometimes said, it's like a hot potato. They just kept tossing it to someone else. Nobody wanted to touch it. And apparently these topics embarrassed them and made them uncomfortable. I wondered why, and I began to discover that this was an enormous black hole, so to speak, an empty spot, rather, in academic research. Nobody was teaching it. Nobody was researching it. The academy somehow was not interested and did not see this as a valid topic. I didn't understand why. I was very naive, maybe, at the time. I had no clue why not, because this was so obviously interesting. So I thought, well, okay, if nobody's doing it, then I'm going to do it. And so that is how I got into the topic. And then at one point, of course, once you start delving deeper, you start discovering that there have been people studying this. And in this way, I entered all kinds of blind alleys, etc., and read the wrong stuff and got confused and tried again, etc., as usual. But eventually I came across the works of a French scholar, Antoine Fèvre, who had, as it turned out, the first chair in Western esotericism at the University of Paris, and at the Sorbonne, affiliated to the Sorbonne in Paris. And he was talking about all this stuff. He called it Western esotericism. He described it as a grand, interesting, influential tradition from the Renaissance on, from the 15th century on to the present. And so I was hooked. I thought, well, this is what I want to study. And then there's even a further dimension. And this was the time in the, in the later 80s, when the New Age movement was really gathering steam and coming up and getting very popular. And at this time, there were all kinds of New Age bookshops popping up in where I was living. I was walking into this. I sometimes entered those shops. I was curious. I didn't know anything about it. I saw all these strange combinations of books about Indian religions, about occult stuff, magic, psychology, astrology, whatever. And I was wondering, where does this all come from? And that made me curious. So I started looking more closely at it, and then I realized that there was actually a connection, that all this kind of stuff was historically related to the same stuff that Fevre was studying. So it became more and more interesting. I saw saw that this was very relevant to things that were happening happening right around me. And I saw that there was a large historical tradition behind all this stuff. But once again, I saw that nobody was studying it. So, okay, so I felt this New Age stuff has to be studied. Somebody has to look at it. And I was doing it not from a sociological perspective, because there were some people who were studying this sociologically. But I was interested in the ideas and where do they come from, the historical backgrounds.
I think one of the wonderful things...
So this is how I got into the field.
Yeah, one of the wonderful things about that book in particular for me, having also been interested in New Age, you know, going to New Age bookstop shops and reading these things, reading contemporary texts and some of the historical things that you'd find there, trying to get a sense of where this stuff came from, is that by showing these connections between contemporary spiritual thinking, occult thinking, and these deep historical currents that go back to the Renaissance and even earlier. Well, I mean, one of the wonderful things about the study, besides just being interesting, where you see how these underground ideas continue to have influence, is that looking at how things change, how these ideas change and get reconstituted, mm-hmm. is a wonderful way of understanding how modern history itself has changed, so that
there you go.
You know, you show how, especially in the 19th century, ideas, let's say, of Darwin and evolution, or the emergence of psychology as a science, how these things become absolutely fundamental to these currents in a way that they were never before, and then that becomes sort of the new shape, the new expression of some of these more ancient or older inspirations or movements. So it's a wonderful way to get a handle on the way that society itself is changing.
Yeah, I agree absolutely. I couldn't agree more. But it's interesting that you're emphasizing this point right away, because this immediately brings us to an somewhat contested dimension of studying all these things. And that is that, on the one hand, there is a kind of an assumption among a lot of people who are personally interested in esotericism, who believe that there is this kind of universal tradition which has always been there, and which was already there in antiquity, and which has just been passed on the universal wisdom. And on the other hand, then you have the historical approach, which says, well, things are always changing and transforming. And there are enormous differences between what people were believing among the Gnostics or the Hermetists in antiquity, and what you find in the Renaissance, and then what you find in the 19th century, the 20th century, and our own time. So this notion of transformation, of change, you know, I absolutely agree that by studying this stuff, you are beginning to see very fundamental changes and developments that have created foundations of our own world. But it's important to see that, yes, there is, on the one hand, there is this notion of universality, of a universal truth, and at the same time, there is this, in fact, actually, if you start looking at it historically, then you're struck by how earlier traditions are continually being reinterpreted from new perspectives and changed into something that earlier generations could never have imagined.
Well, let's stay with this point about the tension between, let's call it, universality and history,
yeah.
Because I think that's a really important thing to emphasize in terms of the kind of work that you're doing, and indeed that many scholars are doing now, in contrast to an earlier sort of phase of scholarship around these matters that has been, of course, very influential. And I'm referring to people like Mircea Eliade and yes. Carl Jung with his writings on alchemy. I mean, apparently, you know, you could look at Jung as someone, well, isn't he doing what you're talking about? He's talking about the history of alchemy. He's showing how it's relevant to a modern psychological framework, that it rests on these sort of deep structures of consciousness, et cetera, et cetera. And indeed, I think a lot of people who get interested in these matters, if they're also interested intellectually as well as practically, they're inevitably going to wind up reading these authors, and it becomes a sort of modern way of understanding how these currents work that really emphasizes this kind of universalism. But you're representing a different phase, and even if you could even talk about your friend and colleague Antoine Febb in this context, I think his career is very interesting because he starts out very much in that vein, and then he makes a very pointed change to a more historical approach. So,
well, Eric, I'd also just like to interject super quick. Those two people you talked about, Nietzsche and Carl Jung, both went through it. They actually did it, right? And that aspect of their lives was removed from the history. No one talks about Mircea Eliade's involvement in the Tantra cults. No one talked about, I mean, the Red Book of Jung's Madness just was released, so it's important to remember that part, too.
So I would be interested in talking more about these tensions, how we think about what were some of the insights that these scholars, these earlier generation of scholars had, perhaps partly because they did go through their own experiences. They had their own forms of gnosis, and that motivated their work, and yet the claims they made as scholars are not necessarily as solid looking today as they were when they had their sort of when they were really writing at their peak. So I'd love to hear you talk thread your way through some of these issues. I think they're very important for people.
Yeah, it's a very difficult point. It's not easy to. I'll do my best. This book that you mentioned earlier in the introduction, this Esotericism and the Academy that I published last year, very much emphasizes that there are two main approaches to this whole field. One that I call, with a term that is quite common nowadays, religionism. And religionism refers to the kind of approach that looks for something universal, unchanging, a kind of universal truth in esoteric traditions, and that tries to focus on that as the most important part of esotericism. And on the other hand, you have an historical approach that I represent, which is not studying esoteric traditions in an effort to try to find the truth, but leaves the question of what is true or false to others. And considers this as a question that is, that's not possible for scholars to answer. So these are two approaches. And one thing I have to say right away is that I often notice that people think, who have heard a little bit about my work, think that I'm an enemy of religionism, that I think it's bad or something like that. That's not at all the case. Many of the greatest scholars in this field, and Antoine Febvre is one of them, but other people would be indeed Mircea Eliade, and Henri Corbin, the French scholar, is another one. And you could mention a whole range of others. These were very, very great, very, very impressive people, whom I enormously respect in their thinking and in their work, and at the same time that I disagree with in their approach. So it's quite possible to disagree and still respect somebody that you're reading. And the problem is with this approach that in order to really make statements about what is universal and true in historical traditions that you're studying, you have to go beyond history and take an approach which is itself esoteric and which is no longer scholarly and historical. And the way that I'd like to look at the distinction of these two approaches, a kind of an esoteric approach to esotericism on the one hand and an historical approach on the other hand, I like to compare it to playing tennis or badminton. You can take any other kind of sport. That's a kind of analogy I'd like to make. If I'm playing tennis, if I'm doing history, what I'm doing, which is my profession, then I'm playing tennis. It means there are certain boundaries that I have to respect, certain rules. The ball can bounce once and not twice, otherwise I lose the point, etc., etc. There are all these rules, and within that set of rules, I can play tennis. Now, it's quite possible that as a scholar, I'm playing tennis, and that I also like to play badminton, and badminton then stands for being involved in some kind of esoteric practice. It's quite possible that I might want to play both games, and sometimes play badminton, which has another set of rules that I have to take into account, than tennis. The only thing is that you cannot combine them at the same moment. If I'm playing tennis and my opponent wants to observe part of the rules of badminton, then we cannot play. So the way that I look at it is I have a lot of respect for esoteric, internally oriented approach to esotericism, but it's something different from what you do at the academy. And I think it's a good thing to be clear about those differences and to have mutual respect but not mix them. And this is, I think that's very important for it, because one of the problems in the study of esotericism, as it has developed under the influence of people like Eliade, et cetera, during the 1960s, 70s, 80s, is that that if you are very much interested in finding the truth, the universal wisdom or whatever it may be, then you tend to be less attentive, almost automatically, at anything that might disrupt that assumption of a universal truth. And that means that you will be less interested and less attentive to the changes and to the developments and the transformations and to the fact that, esotericist in the 1960s is actually very different from somebody in the 16th century. Right?
I just want to interject quickly. There's a good example of what you're talking about. Werner Heisenberg wrote his book, What is Life? And he is a quantum physicist, of course, developed his whole career, and he was very scholarly and kind of like obeyed the rules. And then later on in his career, he wanted to do biology, and he became very interested in biology, but he couldn't play tennis and badminton at the same time. He was rejected by the community of biologists. They said, you can't come in here and just think you can come and learn biology. And this is Werner Heisenberg, for crying out loud. Like, this is someone who, played by all the rules of tennis, but then he got kicked out of badminton. So what you're saying is very true.
Okay. I do not know about the case of Heisenberg, so I cannot comment on that. I know who he is, of course, but I do not know that this happens to him. But that's interesting.
Yeah.
But I do have to say that this is my opinion, and you may perhaps disagree. I don't know. That I think that scholarly research is something that has its own limitations and its rules. It has its limitations, and I think a certain attitude of humility is important for scholars. There's a lot of things about esotericism that scholars cannot answer, but it has a lot of things that it can do better as well. Esoteric approaches is something different. It has its own strengths and its own weaknesses, and so I think that it's not a good thing to mix them.
No,
it's
I understand. Here's the question I have for you on this score, and it's there's like kind of two parts to it. One is that as you write about in all of your books, but you certainly make a good point of it in the current Western Guide to the Perplexed, is that one aspect of studying esotericism and taking it seriously as a cultural phenomenon is something that's working in individuals as well as in books and communities, is that there's a role for altered states, that clearly some of what we're discovering, almost certainly even in ancient texts, when you read some of the texts of the Corpus Hermeticum and you talk about this very in very clear terms, that it seems very much like they're referring to what we could call altering consciousness or altered states of consciousness. There's different words we could use, and those differences are important. But let's just think for a moment that there are these potentials in the mind, in the brain, in the nervous system. And while they may be expressed in different ways in different cultures or interpreted differently, the way that, say, dreams are interpreted very differently in different cultures, nonetheless, you can sort of make the universal case that all human beings dream on some manner.
There you go. Yep.
So the question I have about this problem of universalism, the desire among earlier scholars certainly to find some universal core that was reflected in multiple different traditions and thereby sometimes make errors historically because they want everything to look more similar. But do you think there's also a tension or a potential universalism of some careful character in our explorations, if we're playing the scholarly game, in our explorations of altered states of the nervous system and how the nervous system is triggered, transformed, reframed by these different practices in a way that seems to suggest the possibility of some kind of universal approach?
Yeah. Well, I think you're absolutely right. This is a point that I have been emphasizing quite a lot in recent years, because the human cycle physiological organism hasn't changed that much over a couple of thousand years. So that is pretty universal, and it's true. It's absolutely true that if you subject people to certain kind of circumstances, for instance, sensory deprivation, I just mentioned one example, then we react very much in the same way. And you can, with a certain kind of certainty, predict what will happen when you subject people to a certain kind of circumstance. There's other certain meditative techniques, or drumming, or techniques of breathing, etc., etc., which have certain effects which are pretty universal. And I think, yes, this is an aspect where the aspect of universality is quite big, and I think that if somebody engages in, let's say, some kind of meditative technique and gets into a kind of an altered state, in a trance state or an ecstatic state or whatever you want to call it, then what he or she experiences in that state there's a certain universality to it, but it's also partly influenced by the culture of his time and period. So if a Buddhist and a Christian or an atheist are doing the same techniques, exactly the same techniques, then the Buddhist is likely to see the Buddha, maybe. Christians are likely to see Christ, and atheists will certainly not see God. Or at least they may see something that others would interpret as God, but they would interpret differently. So I think the interesting thing is the interaction between the universality of specific altered states and the cultural specificity of a whole range of experiences that you can have in those kind of states. Yeah, and I think that's absolutely fascinating to study.
And one thing that's happening now, and I mean, we're going to have to take a break after this, and we can talk more about this in the second half.
Sure.
But I just want to mention it now, is that we haven't really talked about contemporary esotericism, and I will ask you about that in the second half of the program. But one of the things that distinguishes some contemporary esotericism or contemporary occultism is that process of universal physiological states and cultural interpretation, that process is part of their esotericism. It's becoming more self-conscious about how these things operate in a really remarkable way that really shows a great deal of vitality. But in a way, I'm being unfair, because we do have to take a break here, and we'll be back and talk more in just a second. You're listening to Expanding Mind with Eric Davis and Maja Daou. We're talking with Wouter Hanegraaff, who is a professor at the University of Amsterdam in Hermetic Traditions, the history of Hermetic Traditions. And we'll be right back after this.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. This is Maja Daou, and we're here with Mr. Eric Davis. We're both very excited to be speaking with Professor Wouter Hanegraaff about esotericism done properly, right? Proper, yes, studying it correctly. And kind of to play off what Eric was saying a little bit before the break, I always like to ask the folks we have on the show, especially scholars. I know you mentioned earlier that you have had some experiences of, you know, some of the nature of esoteric information or the way it works through your music, but I was curious if, you know, through your studies or even through your work with this material, if you've had any just crazy magical experiences that you'd like to share, you know, no matter what format they were in, if you could pick maybe one that was just incredible to you to share with the folks that are listening.
Okay, I understand your question. Well, you know, let me say first of all that I've made a very interesting experience teaching this stuff at the University of Amsterdam since 1999, essentially, for 14 years now. So you teach about these things, and what happens again and again is that in the break or after my course, students come to see me and they say, well, could I tell you something, and could we talk in private about something? This happens again and again. And then I say, okay. And then they start telling me about very weird, strange experiences that they've had. Things that they usually don't dare to talk about because they think that their family or their friends will think that they're crazy. Hmm. And a lot of people have weird experiences. And for instance, I just give one example here. There is a student who came to me and she had never had any strange experiences as far as she could remember. Until one day, she was sitting in the student room, looking at a white wall, and suddenly the wall became like a film screen, and she was looking at a scene as if she was flying high up in the air, and she was seeing a landscape in great detail, full color 3D, and she was like she was a bird, she was flying over that landscape, and that went on for hours, literally, she says. And she was watching, and she was just sitting in this room looking at the wall, but that's what she saw, with incredible clarity and precision and the detail. And it went on for hours. That was a reason for her to change her course of study and study philosophy. And then she also ended up doing a course with me. And the interesting thing for me is that she said, this was very important in my life, and I do not know what to do with it because if I mention it, people will think I'm crazy. And maybe you will understand. And so she assumed that I would understand. And she was right. I do understand. Not in the sense that I know what happened to her exactly with this experience. But, I don't think I'm very comfortable talking greater details about my personal life in this context. But, yes, I have had some weird experiences that people might consider strange. And the point is that I've had weird experiences, definitely, of the sort that you sometimes see reflected in esoteric sources. But the point is that it's not unusual. A lot of people have those. And okay. I think one thing that I like, I would hope that the study of esotericism, if it gets more normal in the academy to study this thing, I hope that one effect of it will be that it will become more normal to talk about these things, and it will no longer be considered weird and crazy, and you will no longer be suspected of being ripe for the hospital or something if you have strange experiences, because I think that a lot of people have such experiences, and I don't think it's unusual. On the other hand, I also think that it's possible to train your ability to become more susceptible or more sensitive to this
kind
of operation.
Have you met any modern esotericists, like people that actually practice? Is there anyone met that recently,
absolutely,
like a modern person that engages in this that really impressed you?
No, of course. Are you kidding? Of course, I'm meeting them all the time. Of course. I mean, where you study this, of course, I know a lot of people who are having such experiences and who are practicing esotericism in all kinds of ways. Yes, of course. And I think it's very important for scholars, also for historians like me, and not just to look at the past, but to look at the present. Maybe I could make a small point about this. The study of esotericism has been developing, like Eric said, for about 12 years, 12, 15 years, maybe 20 years, depends where you start. And it has been set up in the academy as an historical field of study. In very recent years, one of my PhD students has really, with a couple of colleagues, has really made a point of saying, listen, it's important to look at what's happening right now. For instance, in popular culture, there is an incredible amount of esotericism around, and there used to be a certain risk in my field of study that we were looking only at the past, maybe the recent past, but not looking around at what's happening right here. And I think it's very important to do that. because esotericism is no longer marginal. One of my colleagues, Chris Partridge, has written a book about the re-enchantment of the world, and he makes the point that that what he calls occulture, that is the term that he has coined, or hasn't coined it, but he has made it popular, occulture, like the presence of occult dimensions and ideas and practices in popular culture, is not something strange or marginal, but it is absolutely popular, and it's everywhere. You find it in movies, you find it in video games, you find it in popular literature. You find it anywhere. You find it in popular music.
Well let's stay on this a little bit and maybe ask you to speculate a little bit on the following question. In your first book in particular, you talk about how you can look at the New Age as a transformation of older esoteric currents, and you become specific with certain ones, and you describe them and show the connection. But it's a transformation that's happening because of larger changes in Western culture and really global culture. In your examples, again, we talked about Darwin, we talked about the rise of psychology, we talked about there's questions of the liberalization of religious marketplaces, so people have more options, and all of these help to transform the shape of esotericism into something that we could recognize in that case as the New Age. Talking about this popular culture realm, the fact that there's esoteric themes all over the place. I mean, we deal with this a lot on Expanding Mind, and it's been a topic of fascination for me throughout my writing career and Maja as well. What do you think that says about where we are, about the nature of truth today, about the role of consciousness or culture in mapping our world today? Because there's something very specific about the occulture today, and in the last couple of decades that wasn't the case in the 1950s or any time earlier than that, even though there was artistic esotericism, absolutely, but it seems like something else is happening now that reflects something current, again, in that esoteric mirror.
Yeah. Oh, it's another difficult question. One thing that comes to mind is that I think that, strangely enough, maybe it seems counterintuitive at first, but strangely enough, I think that postmodernism is very important here. Postmodernism can mean all kinds of things, of course, but what I mean is that, let's say since the 1990s, Western society, we have lost faith in these traditional grand narratives, the grand narratives of secular progress, the grand narrative of science that's going to solve all our problems, or the grand narrative of Christian, Christian narratives of salvation, etc. They have been basic to the way that we looked at ourselves and our history and our world, and they were still basic in the 1960s, and they've started breaking down. And I think that we are seeing since the 1990s is a kind of a very broad postmodern, I would call it like that, postmodern mentality, which is no longer highbrow and intellectual, but is very widely shared among the population. There are no grand narratives anymore. So there is much more openness towards all kinds of suppressed narratives or smaller narratives that used to be seen as heretical or crazy or strange or irrational, etc. And there's not so much resistance anymore against taking this stuff seriously.
And so I think one dimension about this, and it's something reason. You've also written about, I know in regards to H.P. Lovecraft, is that it seems like one of the features of our current postmodern esotericism is a much broader embrace of fiction as a source of something, let's say, that's gesturing beyond fiction, and yet does not get congealed into some kind of belief structure necessarily. So there are people happy cultivating fictions beyond the normal boundaries of fiction, and yet not necessarily going, well, this means that, Lovecraft was actually tapping into the reality of deities who are exist on different dimensions of our reality, but they're comfortable playing on the borderline between fiction and reality. And that seems to be something genuinely new, or for the most part genuinely new, and it's something very deep about our moment and very clearly reflected in a lot of esotericism. Would you say that's partly true?
Oh, I think that's absolutely true. I have to say, this topic of what some people call invented religions, others call it hyper-real religions, there are all kinds of types, names for it. It's an absolutely fascinating new phenomenon. Like you're referring to, there are people who are modern magicians who are invoking the gods from the Cthulhu mythos of Lovecraft, knowing that they are invented, but invoking them anyway, and because it works quite as well as invoking gods that are seen as ontologically present in reality outside. So the whole distinction between an ontological outside reality or a fictional reality is breaking down, and this is. This is a very strong example of the impact of, let's say, postmodern mentalities in contemporary esotericism. So I completely agree with you.
I wanted also to give you a chance to talk about another element of contemporary esotericism and recent esotericism that you've also begun writing about more in recent years, and I'm hoping you're going to do more work on this topic in particular, because it's something that's close to my heart, and our show is what you call entheogenic esotericism.
Yes.
And I'd love to hear you talk a little bit about that and what you mean by that and why you use that phrase.
Yeah, entheogenic esotericism. Right. Well, as I don't think I have to explain to the listeners of your show what entheogenic means. It refers to mind-altering substances, let's say, which are believed to give access to some kind of spiritual dimension. Now I'm fascinated by this. I have a general interest in emphasizing the importance of alterations of consciousness or altered states of consciousness in esotericism. Like you said earlier, I think already if you start with Plato, even with Plato, going back as far as that, if you allow me to digress for 1 or 2 minutes on this,
sure.
I think it will be interesting. Then I will get back to the contemporary scene and to entheogenic esotericism. But if you look at Plato, one of the most important dialogues of Plato, the Phaedrus, talks about four forms of what he calls mania, madness. And madness means here a higher kind of madness, not insanity, but it means a state of divine consciousness, basically, being filled with divinity. And he distinguishes four of them, a prophetic one, and one that is induced by rituals, one that is induced by music or poetry, and one that is induced by love. He talks about them, and at the highlight of this dialogue, Socrates, the protagonist of Plato, gives a kind of inspired speech, which is not philosophy, it's not rational, it's an inspired speech, inspired by the gods, in a kind of what we would call an altered state of consciousness. So I think this importance of these kind of states, as states in which you are believed to receive divine insight, divine knowledge, etc., etc., is there from the very beginnings of our civilization. But in the way that philosophy is usually taught to us, these dimensions of, let's say, philosophy of Plato tend to be marginalized or suppressed because it doesn't fit the picture of philosophy as rational, because it shows that philosophy can also be based upon alterations of consciousness. Now, I think that this, if you look at that, those kind of phenomena, starting with Plato, you can trace it through the history of Western culture, and it is fundamental to Western esotericism. One other example, Jacob Böhme, I mentioned him earlier, 17th century visionary, an extremely important figure in the history of esotericism. all his work is based upon an experience of illumination that happened to him when he was 25 years old. And which was another very clear state of alterations of consciousness, an altered state, a trance state, in which he saw the presence of divinity in everything. And first he thought it was a temptation of the devil, but then he realized that it was actually a divine state that was given to him, etc. So there are so many examples of this, and I think it has been underestimated. Now, what I find fascinating is that from the beginning of the 19th century, certainly later 19th century and the 20th century, you see an increasing situation where esotericists are using mind-altering substances, psychoactive substances, whatever you want to call them, in order to expand our mind and get access to higher forms of knowledge. And I have come to the conclusion that this whole dimension has been hugely underestimated by scholars, probably because scholars are trained to be focused on rationality and etc. and tend to be a bit uncomfortable studying these kind of dimensions. But I think if those dimensions are important in esotericism, we have to study them, whether we are comfortable with them or not. Now, in this article you're referring to about entheogenic esotericism, I am criticizing my own earlier work. You mentioned this book on the New Age that I wrote that I published in 1996. There's a passage there which surprises me now. I read it now. I say there that that the role, of course, psychoactive drugs were very important in the 1960s, as everybody knows. And then I say, well, they were no longer important to the New Age movement as it developed in the 70s and the 80s and so on. Psychoactive substances played no role in the New Age. That's what I say. I read it now, and I think it was incredibly naive to write that, because I've come to realize that in a lot of the literature and the popular books that you read that were fundamental to the New Age, the impact of these substances is still there, but still simply for very obvious reasons. People don't talk about it.
Would like to really quickly address this, because it's something you've been talking about since the beginning of the show. It's something I deal with a lot. In your opinion, why do you think these matters are so taboo? We're in a culture where it's perfectly acceptable for scholars to make bombs, make atomic bombs that will kill, you know, millions of people. We'll make chemical weapons. We will perform all manner of atrocities. But it's not okay to talk about entheogens. It's not okay to talk about magic. What, in your opinion, what is the reason for this? Can you kind of say, like, why?
Yeah. Well, it gets very complicated, because this book that I published last year is about the emergence of this category of rejected knowledge, as I call it. And I try to explain there why esotericism came to be seen as rejected knowledge, as the other of established rational scientific thinking, why that happened. That's a very long story, and I don't think I will be able to tell that story in the 10 minutes that we've left. But when it comes to, although I would love to, it's no problem, but I don't think we have time. It's a long story. But I do think you can say is that when it comes to mind-altering substances, etc., and the whole topic of expanding your consciousness or changing your consciousness in some way, I think that Western culture, especially Christianity, established Christianity, has had a problem with this from the beginning. As you see with the Gnostics, the Gnostics were seen as the heretics par excellence, and they were focusing Gnosis. Gnosis was a direct individual spiritual experience. And that was problematic for the establishment, because, for the emerging orthodoxy, simply because, any Gnostic could have his own experience and start his own interpretation of Christianity, and before you know it, they all form their own interpretations, and it becomes chaos. So they have had trouble with that all along. Then, of course, the Enlightenment and the Scientific Revolution, etc., have had their own problems with personal spiritual experience, because it's not rational enough. So I think that our culture as a whole is built upon foundations that inherently has problems accepting the fact that people can have impressive insights through alterations of consciousness. And this goes deep into our culture, and I think it's one of the fundamentals. The rejection of this kind of approach is, I think, is one of the fundamentals, the foundations, I should say, of traditional Western culture. And yeah,
that's a wonderful answer, and I think it also points to, it's in addition to just how interesting this material is, how much it illuminates history, the history of thought, of philosophy, of art, of music. I mean, we didn't even talk about the influence of this on artistic movements in the 20th century, which is just, enormous. But in addition to the inherent interest of the subject, it also is a wonderful place to sit in order to understand some of the fundamental conflicts, contradictions, some of which are quite difficult and have a lot of very problematic consequences just in our current paradigm, if you will. And I really give you a shout out of appreciation for helping to illumine these things. We only have a couple of minutes left, and I wanted to let people know about you have a blog at wouterjhanegraaff.blogspot.nl called Creative Reading. And Hanegraaff is HANEGRAAFF. And I also will just let you give an opportunity to say what else you're doing, if there's anything coming out, if there's a place that people can read some of your things online.
Mm. Yeah, right. Well, there's maybe two things. We have an academic program, and I'm very proud to say that at present we are still the only complete program in the world. Both on the bachelor and the master level of education in the study of this field. So that's in Amsterdam, University of Amsterdam. And if you're interested, you can check this out on our website, which is amsterdamhermetica.nl or .com. That's the website. And secondly, there's an international organization of scholars in this field, which is called the European Society for the Study of Western Esotericism, ESWE. And that has a website as well, which is www.esswe.org.
ESSWE.org,
yes.
Great. Well, Professor Hanegraaff, thanks so much for being with us on Expanding Mind.
Okay. I thank you very much for the opportunity, and I very much liked the conversation.
Wonderful. All right, from me and Majid, all you out there, keep your minds open.